This is Jardina London, and I'm here with Agile Uprising, hopefully shaking up their thinking today.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Jay Hersko, back again. Topic of this episode, we're going to be talking about a recent white paper that I came across through the Business Agility Institute titled Structural Agility. And we were lucky enough to get the paper's author, Ms. Jardina London. Jardina, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. So happy to be here.
We are glad to have you. So before we go into the contents of the paper, just wanted to give you a second to introduce yourself to our listeners who may not be familiar with you or some of your work.
Yeah, so my name is Jardina London. I do mostly business agility consulting, but I do a lot of speaking and writing. I have a blog that I've been writing about soulfulness at work, the founder of soulsatwork.org, trying to bring more soul into the workplace. And my recent book just came out yesterday, Cultivating Transformations, which is a leader's guide to connecting the soulful and the practical.
Perfect. So I came across your work, Jardina. I think it was, funnily enough, I think it was another podcast. It might've been InfoQ or it might've been Accenture. I'm not sure which one. Like we were talking about before we started recording, I threw it in the queue. It was on a playlist. And one day I was listening and we were talking about it yesterday, how I actually have a post-it here with a bunch of quotes that I wrote down of things that I picked up. So that's why I wanted to reach out and have you on to talk about a paper, which it's only 20 something pages. And yet I read it and then I read it again. And then I read it again. And then I sent it to someone else who sent it to someone else. So it's worked our way through my ecosystem. So I wanted to start off by basically getting down to brass tacks and saying, if I got cornered by you in an elevator and I said, oh, I think I know you. You wrote that paper on structural agility. And I turn to the third party that's next to us and says, this is Jardina London. She wrote a paper on structural agility. How do you explain what structural agility is if I'm walking into an elevator with you and you really only got a couple seconds?
So first of all, poor you for walking into an elevator with me. Because I, you know, my whole thing is that I love to go deep. I love to get to the essence and peel back all the stuff. And that's exactly what I was doing with structural agility, because I didn't understand it. I wanted to peel back all that noise and just like, what's the essence here that we're really talking about? So in answer to your question, so what is structural agility? So the first thing I did was like define it, because I didn't understand it. And I found that nobody else did either. So we define it. So I mean, I'll tell you that the official definition was that it's the capability to continually create and adapt structures that give life and enable the flow of value in sync with and in response to the organization's changing environment.
Right? Perfect.
Yeah. So it's this building of this continuous structure.
And when you define it that way, right? And you know, you and I had a conversation yesterday talking a lot about nomenclature and words that we use and how, you know, semantic collapse, the word agile doesn't mean what it used to mean. One of the things that caught my eye and caught my ear when you just said it back again is the usage of the word or the term give life, right? Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk a little bit about that, because when you think about some of the process heavy stuff that we see in our world, right? It's do this, get this. It's almost like a deterministic type behavior. Whereas when you say give life, that's kind of loose, but at the same time, it kind of fits. So yeah. Where did that come from?
So I have a person that I collaborate very heavily with, Sally Parker, and her whole consultancy is around living systems, creating organizations as living systems. So as we sort of started collaborating together and talking about the mechanistic nature of organizations today and what they would be like if they were living systems, and agility lines up so perfectly with living systems and creating and looking at organizations as living systems. So the big thing, and not that we're going to do away with mechanistic, but the big thing to think about there is, again, peeling away to the essence, is when you have a mechanistic system, you've built a machine, you've built a factory, it can only do what you've designed it to do, for the most part, right? Sometimes they get away from us, but for the most part, when you design a living system, it can expand outside of what you imagined. So that's what we want to do. We want to grow these. These is about growing things, not building inside a box.
And that is, I think that's, and again, that's one of the things that caught me about your paper, is sometimes we get caught in this rut where we think of an organization, forgetting that some of the Latin roots of that word, or not some of the Latin roots of that word, come from organism. So it's a living, breathing entity. It's always going to evolve, devolve, or change, depending upon what the environment needs of it. So, and that's another thing when you talked about, and the next part we're going to talk about, you talk about, you know, structure enables flow. That's one of the first quotes I pulled out of the paper because I was like, my God, this is brilliant. Why haven't anybody thought of this before? It's so simple and it makes so much sense. We look at things as two in a box. And there needs to be, instead of looking at an organization like a, and I think Jeff Anderson talks about this in his Agile Organizational Design, instead of looking at it like a pyramid, it needs to really look at more like a center with rings around it, a varying distance from the center. But back to your quote, right? Structure enables flow, right? Yeah. Let's talk about that for a second. Where does, what led you to come to that light bulb moment?
Yeah. So that was another thing about living systems. So if you think about the metaphors, and I don't want to get too lost in the metaphors here because I'm not an ecologist, but when we think about structure enabling flow in nature, so if you think a river is the easiest thing I can think of. So how does structure enable flow in a river? Well, if you don't have any riverbank, you're not really, you know, the water doesn't flow as freely, doesn't flow as fast. When you have a high riverbank, you're channeling that water to flow more quickly. And then there's other things, right? So there's things that can slow the flow of the river, rocks and other things, but there's things that can speed the flow of the river. By putting structure in it, it actually speeds the flow. The bends can slow it, a waterfall can speed it, right? Like, so all these different structures that you have can actually help enable the flow. So in organizations, so the metaphor in an organization, structure, and we've used it in the past to, when you use it for control, it can slow the flow. Mm-hmm. When you use it to enable flow and create better throughput, then it can really help your organization. So if you think of an organization, for example, where where it's not clear what the boundaries are, it's all about boundaries. And it's not clear who's the decision maker, let's say, as an example, then it's sort of like pouring water onto your counter, right? Don't get made and nobody's really sure and they kind of hang out there for a while versus pouring water into a glass with mm-hmm. some boundary that it can still be permeable, right? It can still have flow in and out. You have a top to the glass, but you can actually contain it and channel it.
And you, I think that you definitely just did that on the fly, but that's a brilliant analogy about pouring water on your countertop, right? Because water always follows the path of least resistance. Mm-hmm. So in an organization, if there aren't clearly defined, they don't need to be hard boundaries, but at least need some bounded context, people are going to do whatever makes the least amount of waves because they again, here we come with the incentive part of our human brain, right? They're going to do what they're incented to do. What's going to get the biggest incentive. And it typically is don't make waves. So they're just going to, and this is how bad behaviors get repeated ad infinitum.
Right. Exactly.
So one of the things we deal with is organizational change agents, right? Transformations notwithstanding, right? Any type of organizational change or movement you want to do. Why, in your experience, why do so many organizations drag their feet when it comes to the idea of changing structure?
So let's just step back before I answer that and be super clear about what structure is. Because actually, before I started writing this paper, I thought it was org chart, right? Mm-hmm. So org chart is part of it, but it's anything that bounds work or people. So it could be your informal structure that's not in your org chart, your team or whatever. But it's also how we're bounding the work. So projects, tasks, stories, epics, right? That's all structure. So why are organizations reluctant to change it? So I think the biggest thing there is that we have created so much dependency on structure that undoing it is like the mandrake in Harry Potter, right? Like it's screaming mm-hmm. when you're pulling it out because it's so connected to everything else. So if I say, people have done this, like, so we're doing this in Agile, right? We're saying no more projects. It's not project-based anymore. It's going to be product-based or something else. And then it's like, everyone's screaming because our budgets are based on project structure. Our org charts are based mm-hmm. on, like, everything's based on a project structure. So when you pull that out, the organization screams like a mandrake.
That's the first time I think we've had a Harry Potter reference on here, which I got to give you credit for. That not the most obscure. I think the most obscure reference, somebody referenced Green Lantern. And I was like, wow, that really went down a rabbit hole there.
Come on. Everybody loves Harry Potter.
Oh yeah, it's true. But it has a cultural relevance that people can, you know, everybody pictures the little ball that makes all the noise. So when we get into the paper, right. And I don't want to drain the paper because I do want people to go out and download it and read it. you mm-hmm. propose principles for structural agility, right? And I don't want to, there's nine of them and I think they're all great and I don't want to talk through all of them, but I do want to touch on a couple because they really resonated with me. The first one is you have number two, which is continuous design allows the organization to evolve. So in the agile world, in the DevOps world, in the lean flow world, they talk all the time about continuous integration and continuous delivery. But I think there's almost like a cognitive bias that they don't think about a continuously evolving organization structure. Yeah. And that I think, and I'm sure you're going to agree, that that's paramount. So when you think about that whole environment, how does one create an environment where they have the ability to continuously evolve the organization as learning grows?
Mm. Yeah. So there's a lot of structures that are proposed as examples for this or practices. But the idea is that you're designing for redesign instead of designing for every 5-year cycle with your consultants coming in, which I'm a consultant, but still, right? So you're designing with an eye towards a continuous evolution. So like, for example, let me back up for a second. One of the reasons that we put the nine principles into place is because we wanted a way to look at all the frameworks that are out there. So I'll mention a framework here, and it's just an example that fits into, you know, you can fit it into the mm-hmm. principles. So if you look at Holacracy is a way of designing for continuous evolution, right? So the rules of the game are we can create new roles, we can create mm-hmm. new structures, right? So there are some rules about like, what has to happen? What's the threshold? What is the criteria to go create a new role, to go create a new team, right? So letting the organization, based on what's happening, go do that.
And I think that ties to another one of your principles here, which is further down the list, number seven, where at every level, the organization has a way to shed and spawn from within itself. So those two are inextricably linked, right? Sure. Because you just talked about, I love this money quote, I wrote it down already, design for redesign. Right. Yeah. So you need to plan for that inevitable evolution.
That's part of your process. The redesign is part of your process. And we do that with Agile, right? Of course, on Agile teams, but mm-hmm. not as an organization.
I had an interesting conversation with Mike Burrows where we talked about that whole idea of continuous improvement and, you know, the plan, do, check, act. And his quote, another post that I got on my board here, where he said, you know, the idea of PDCA is not a perpetual motion machine. It needs work. You need to consistently put the emphasis on plan, do, check, act, plan, do, check, act. Because if not, the inertia falls away. And, you know, I think that's Newton's second law of thermodynamics. Things will just stop moving. Right. So you need to your point, you need to design for that inevitable change, but you also need to cultivate it. Right. I think that's another big part.
Yes. So cultivating is, I love that because that's a living systems word. Right? We're growing this. We're cultivating it. We're planting seeds for it.
Perfect. Perfect. There's another one I want to talk about here, which I think is a blind spot that a lot of practitioners, coaches, transformation gurus have is agility only exists when we create conditions for it instead of directing activity. I'm so glad somebody finally put this into words because you don't show up at client A on the first day, pull out, no offense, safe big picture and say, hey, this is what we're going to do and it's going to get us agility. It's way more than that. And you need to, it's the whole inflict, invite, inspire. And I'm assuming where you were going with that is, you know, in order to change your structure, right, you need to enable the uptake of it by creating the right environment for it. Almost like the you need to build the greenhouse and then plant the seed to let it to grow.
Right. And I want to just give a shout out for like all of these come from existing thinking. So this is that's a shout out to Ron Heifetz and there's a co-author who I can't think of, but the book is Leadership on the Line. And that has been that thinking fed into that part. And there's other thinking you may recognize from other thought leaders. So this is, you know, it's not original, it's pulled in. But
good artists create, great artists steal. Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, the most flattering thing, imitation is a serious form of flattery, right?
Of course. Yes. So I'm not claiming, I just want any listeners to know, like, I'm not claiming authorship of any of this. It's sort of just like the Agile Manifesto, right? Pulling together some ideas that were existing into a definition that we can anchor mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this one, and again, it's about cultivating, right? This is the leadership. Creating as leaders, we're creating conditions for this agility to exist rather than directing the activity and telling people what to do, which is sort of the old way, but has seeped into the new way in some places.
Right. And it ties to the Peter Senge stuff where people don't mind change. They don't like being changed and all that. You know, how does the best way to approach change is, you know, you don't inflict it. You want to inspire or invite it.
Exactly.
One of the principles here is the one I personally would like to spend the most time on, because I find it's the first time I've ever seen this put together in a way that really laid it out logically. And the idea of tension, specifically, you call it dynamic tension, right? Mm-hmm. So if I had to stop and explain the concept of dynamic tensions, then we'll go into the types of meta tensions in a minute. What is dynamic tension? And then how does that relate to what we're trying to do, what we're trying to achieve with structural agility?
Yeah. So when we talk about dynamic tension, and it's also known as polarity, again, shout out to Barry Johnson, who's done a ton of work on polarity. And of course, my collaborator, Sally Parker, who's a big part of that. And she was a big part of number four, the dynamic tensions and creating those. So it is about, we'll talk about this, but it's about, you know, when there's tension between two things, it can be generative or it can be destructive. So using that and having that tension be dynamic and life-giving rather than destructive and life-taking. Mm-hmm. It's so easy. We create tensions. I think there's this thing that we've done in corporations where we create competition because we think it will be generative, but we don't do anything to make sure it's generative. So we pit two people, and we'll talk about this with how it shows up in Agile, but we pit two different factions against each other, hoping that something good will happen and leaving it really to chance. So that those tensions need to be managed to make sure that they are doing what we thought that they would do.
You bring up a good point about hoping for the best, mm-hmm. right? You look at some, when you said hoping that it kind of works out, pitting two people against each other, all I could think about was, I think it was an Atlas, the Greek god that was eating his siblings in the womb, right? You know, so, you know, hoping for the best. And then what happens is maybe not the best comes out on top.
Yeah. So in organizations, you know, we see this where I see it typically is you have a compliance organization and like a more innovative, a product organization or some kind of innovation. And they put them together just to make sure that they keep each other in check, but they destroy each other mm-hmm. in some cases it works out great, but you know, you really need to say, to set the tone and set the container that we're putting these two opposing ideas together so that they can get the best from each other. And
right.
Doing that.
It's not a me versus you. It's right. Me and you. And I think you're right. That's where, and I mean, we can go down the leadership rabbit hole for hours, probably. That's where strong leadership comes in to explain that, you know, we're putting you together. It's the same dance as the dev and QA piece, right? Where dev yeah. thinks it's their job to deliver code. And I blame a lot of the contract vendors and how they build their contracts. The QA vendor thinks that their job is to find bugs.
Yeah.
Your job is not to find bugs. Your job is to help them create a better product. But
I used to be a programmer. I will give you that little piece of that little thing. And I had a QA person who used to always find bugs in my code. And she said to me one day, I know you hate me because I'm always finding bugs in your code. And I said, no, I love you because you're always finding bugs in my code.
Right. And I would dare say that attitude probably may be a bit of an outlier, right? Especially when I have worked at places where we have one outsource vendor doing the coding and another outsource vendor doing the testing. And it's literally like watching the Maginot Line in World War I, right? You have the French and the US, and then you have the Germans lobbing, you know, cannonballs or artillery at each other. But they don't realize that if they just kind of talked it out, things would be better off. Man, that was a weird sort of reference ago. Well, moving along. I don't know where that came from. So when you talk about tensions, you actually build on top of the idea of attention when you propose the idea of a meta tension. So let's talk about that. What is a meta tension?
Yeah. So, well, what we did was we sort of figured out what are the top tensions that we see in organizations with regard to structural agility and kind of just in general, really, because these are pretty general. And then when we came up with them, we noticed that three of them really were fed the others. So when we talk about the meta tension, those are sort of like the tensions that are like the father of all tensions. Right. So you can break those down and look at how they show up in different ways. And you may name them differently for your organization, but sort of the parent of it all is, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about spawn and shed already. So spawn and shed can show up in all kinds of different ways, but that's the parent, that meta is mm-hmm. the spawn and shed.
Okay. And then I actually think that, you know, tension is one of those things that is, it's needed when it's used in for a positive force as opposed to a negative, right? Like we've all heard the whole creative tension thing. Get another weird example, go to music, right? You have Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, who don't necessarily, if you've read Keith Richards's book, it's like 900 pages. They don't necessarily like each other, but they find a way. That creative tension is what drives the band forward. More recent example would be the singer guitarist from the Deftones, where you have two different personalities, but that tension actually drives a positive outcome. But I would think, Jardina, that's kind of a slippery slope too, because all it takes is, you know, when I think about polarity, I think of like, you know, a nucleus where two opposing forces are kept in check because they're pretty balanced. But if one gets a little bit more weight on the scale than the other, it could really tip things over and then make everything go haywire.
Yeah. And this is where the work of Barry Johnson comes in. And thank you again to shout out to Barry Johnson of coming up with this process of sitting down and looking at taking the two groups together, facilitating a session where we talk about what's the greater purpose that's driving us both. I mean, presumably you work for the same company. Actually, maybe you don't, but presumably if you're coming together, you have some kind of a shared purpose. Mm-hmm. So what is our shared purpose that we're both? So if I think, go back to the example of compliance and product development, right? We're both trying to help the company be successful. We're not trying to, compliance job is not to kill all products, and product's job is not to get the company sued past the beyond the revenue that they're bringing in, right?
Right.
But we have a purpose of having the company be successful, thriving business. And then what's the downside? What is the fear? What's the fear of product that of too much compliance, that they're going to stop every product? That's our fear. Mm-hmm. What's the fear of compliance of product running, you know, running roughshod,
amok. Yeah.
Right. Is that we're going to be sued, right? So putting those things on the table and then talking about how will we manage those fears so that we can and be generative, and what are the tripwires where we've kind of gone over the top, and having those openly, because that's what's happening, is that they're not mm-hmm. spoken about openly. It's no big, like the super secret thing here of how to manage it is talk about it.
Right. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. So bring it out in the open and acknowledge right. it so we can all talk about it. So, and you actually gave me a perfect segue into my next question. So as organizational change agents, transition people, transformation gurus or coaches, you know, what tips or pointers would you give someone in order to help leverage these tensions? Like, what are some of the things they could do to leverage these for, again, positive manifestation and positive growth, as opposed to, back to my Atlas example, letting them throttle the initiative in the womb before it even gets out the gate?
Yeah. So I think doing that exercise together with the two groups, where you talk about, well, what's the greater purpose we share and what is the fear? Like unpacking those fears of the going too far in one direction of the tension or the polarity, I think is key. And then how we're going to deal with that is a really good place to start. I think also the one that to think about as agilists that we've all seen and experienced, if I'm just going to pick one of these tensions, is stability and change. So that might be a good place to start. Like as agilists, we come in like, we're going to change everything. And the people, you know, forget about stability, but that's where we find the resistance, right? With the stability. So having that conversation when you start implementing agile at a place that hasn't been agile is really important.
And again, here we go with the perfect segue. So one of my next questions I want to ask is, you know, stability is the first thing that we call into question, right? And given enough time on a long enough timeline, I could argue that we weren't stable before, you know, we weren't stable in the waterfall world. So why are you worried about it now? Right. So the shout out to Andrew Leff, who's always saying, whenever someone comes forward and says, what metrics are we going to track during this transformation? His response is typically, well, what metrics do you track now? And are they good? And it, you know, everybody, you know, jams on the brakes because it's that aha moment. As practitioners, we're trying to introduce this idea of structural agility in the service of getting to true business agility. How do I, if I get some time with the powers that be, those that are higher up the totem pole, say I'm working at the portfolio level, how do I start? What's the way you would suggest starting to plant the seeds about these ideas, about the comfortability with not necessarily instability, but the comfortability of change and the comfortability of planting the seeds of agility without, you know, ramming it down everyone's throat and hoping it, you know, generates inside the stomach. What are some of the things you would suggest or would see work for our listeners who maybe do get that 45, 50 seconds of somebody of import, how do they start planting these seeds? How do they start going about getting this idea moving?
I don't really approach it that way.
Okay.
I approach it more of the, what are the things that they want, that they need?
Okay.
Acute pain, because sometimes it's acute pain. I call it the nail in the hand. Like, what's the nail that's through your hand that's stopping you from doing all these wonderful, sure, yeah, we want to be all kinds of wonderful and adaptable, but we have a nail in our hand right now, so we can really hear you.
Right. The burning platform.
Yeah. So what is that burning platform or opportunity that they're not able to leverage? And using that as a launching pad versus trying to force an idea that they're not ready to hear. So, you know, I have clients that I always give this example that if their competitor launches a threat today, then it's going to take them way too long to respond. Right. So we talk through why, like what is standing in your way of responding to a competitive threat? And then as you start to unpack that, it's like, well, we have to get approvals. It has to get budgeted. It has to go up the chain and get budgeted. And then we have to find capacity for it and rejigger everything else that we have in play. Like all these things that have to happen. And then you can go, well, it sounds like you have some tension between stability and change, right? So introducing that as a solution to a burning problem or burning opportunity versus just trying to introduce it.
Right. Not just because, just enough.
Yeah.
I also, you made me think of, I think it's Mike Kottmeyer has that whole base camp idea where are you looking for adaptability or predictability? And mm-hmm. is your business an emergent business where you're constantly finding new things, or is it a convergent business where we have the rules of engagement are already defined and you're really just trying to be more efficient? And that way of looking at things, it's kind of like, you know, like to use your word polarity, right? You're going in right or left. Which is the one that's more pressing, which is the one that's more important for you. And then that can help you dictate where you're going to go.
Yeah. I mean, as agilists, we talk about meet them where they are, but then we don't. And we say, oh, that's man, nice. That's where you
really,
are, but
really challenging some shibboleths here, man.
Yeah. But that's, so I work with different types of clients with different types of strategy in their business, like the Kottmeyer model. And sometimes other agilists will get mad and say, you're not doing agile right. But that's not what their business, that's not how their business works. Their business is, I'm working with someone who's, you know, has a quick turnaround exit strategy. That's different
mm-hmm.
than someone who has a long-term operational strategy, right? So you're going to change your approach. You're going to change which agile tools and practices you use first, right? Depending on where.
Right. It's not one size fits all. It's the equivalent, like we talked about yesterday, it's the equivalent of me getting a Phillips head screwdriver out of my tool bag, using the handle as a hammer to drive a nail, and then saying the screwdriver sucks. Well, yeah. it's not the screwdriver's fault, right? And I have heard you're not doing agile right. That's always a great, whenever that happens, my brain kind of just stops for a second and reboots. You know, it's like a blue screen error, because I can never figure out, I have so many witty responses to that statement that I just kind of just drool, because I don't know what to say that's, am I going to really insult this person? I'm really going to insult this person. Let's move it along.
I've had coaches quit my team because I wasn't, you know, following the Scrum guide or whatever. And, but we're making millions for the client.
Right.
Right.
Results. But, you know, yeah.
Yeah. But we weren't quite following it to the letter.
So I am going to put a link to your paper in the show notes, but I do want to take some time. And I know we talked about this. I want to have you back on once I get a chance to read it. It just came out today. I want to talk about your new book. So let's talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind. You said it came out today?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, today, yesterday, actually. But yes, we'll call it today.
Okay.
So the book is called Cultivating Transformations, again, using that living systems language. And it's about, it's a leader's guide to connecting the soulful and the practical. And one of the things that has become clear to me over the past, I don't know, year, maybe COVID, I don't know, is that, you know, everything I do and everything we do as agilists, quite honestly, is about connecting that soulful and the practical. You know, we do these practices and sure, they make money for the company and they get results, but they're also making better workplaces.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I like your choice of nomenclature. You use the word soulful, right? I mean, there's a lot of discussion nowadays where we're looking at organizations as these giant structured hierarchical, almost like a machine, like it's Taylorism run amok. Whereas in reality, there is a, there is a soul sitting behind it, and you need to be mindful of that. I mean, that cultural, you know, the newsphere, right? What's give me everything that's out in the zeitgeist, all that stuff that's out there. We kind of ignore that sometimes when we come in with a heavy hand and start smashing things around. And like we were talking yesterday, you know, I'm currently working my way through Yuval Harari's Sapiens and Homo Deus, where he talks about that, you know, the culture in the machine. And I'm through a different book club. Anybody who's read, if anybody knows Douglas Hofstadter and they want to get him on, listeners who can talk about God, Alesher Bach, please do. I look forward to my brain melting, but he talks a lot about where is the soul inside of these machines? Where is the, where, how do you define the soul if at the neuron level, our, you and our brains are the same? And in the aggregate, if you look at the makeup of our brain, it's the exact same. Your brain and my brain are made up the exact same way physiologically. Where does the soul come from?
Sure. Right?
But there, that whole idea of treating an organization, an enterprise as a living system, as opposed to just, it is what it is, this is how it works. I pull the lever and the widget comes out. You know, it's like the worst Brazil, you know, Milton Tuttle coming, you know, showing up, and it's terrible. We do need to be more mindful of that, not only just as practitioners, but as people.
And the difference between a living system and a machine is that the living system has soul. I mean, that is the big difference, except for The Soul of a New Machine, which was a wonderful book, but still really machines don't have a soul. Living systems do. And right. The book, and what the book is really about, is then if that's true, that living systems have a soul and we are really running organizations as living systems, and they are living systems, whether we're running them that way or not, right? They're not machines. So that's why they keep hitting us, biting us in the butt, is because we're trying to run them like machines and they're not. But if that's the case, then as leaders, what do we need to do to breathe life and breathe soul and cultivate those souls? The soul of the collective and the souls of the individual, right? Both.
Right. Right. Because machines, I mean, I would argue I would say that machines break down. Living systems don't. Living systems just evolve. Sometimes they evolve into an evolutionary dead end, but they're continuously evolving. Whereas a machine, it will stop and it will just not work. Whereas when you look at our organizations in the aggregate, they are all living systems. I mean, they kind of change as time goes on evolutionarily, but at the end of the day, they're still a living system.
Mm-hmm. And this is why culture eats strategy for lunch, right? Because you're trying to create a machine, but it's sort of, it's growing vines around it, right? The vines are taking over the machine.
Right. And it's going to grow in unexpected ways, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody who's ever tried to plant, you know, Jardine and I are both from Jersey, right? The Garden State. Nobody hold that against me. we know that when you try to plant a garden, right? Especially here, of all places where the ground is so fertile, I have tried to plant tomatoes and I end up with tomatoes and string beans and like six other things. And they just, it kind of goes where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. And instead of forcing it, you know, this ties to modern agricultural practices, instead of forcing it, you really should create that sort of permaculture where it's just baked in. It's just different pieces of the same thing. And it actually leads to resiliency and structural integrity. And, you know, here we can go on about Thomas Jefferson hating cities and whatnot and the coronavirus and all that sort of stuff. Jardina, by the way, is a avid reader. So when she gives her contact information, she'll definitely read any of the books. Her and I are going to do a book report one day. We're just going to talk for hours about nothing. My dog freaks out.
I got to write down this. Every time I talk to you, I hear I got more books to read.
Yeah, it's kind of dangerous. I apologize for that. So we are quickly approaching time, Jardina, and I want to be cognizant of that. So if aside from the link I'm going to put out for the paper, if listeners want to contact you, they have questions, they want to find more information, obviously I will put a link to the book as well. Where can they find you?
They can find all of the things you just mentioned at jardinalondon.com. So it's J-A-R-D-E-N-A, jardinalondon.com. So my book's on there. You can actually get to the paper from there. You can get on my mailing list so that you can keep in touch with all the stuff that's happening and other podcasts and talks. And this podcast, I'll put a link to on there. So yes, all things Jardina are on my website.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you. So once again, Jardina, on behalf of myself and all the listeners, I want to thank you for joining us. On behalf of Jardina and myself, I want to thank all of you listeners for once again tuning in. If you enjoyed the episode, please give us a rating, a review, a comment. You can do it on iTunes, on Spotify. Oh my God, we're on Audible now. You can't trip and fall without finding our episode somewhere. If you want to get in on the conversation, we have a very, very vibrant Discord channel, which will again be in the show notes. If you want to talk about this content and other content you come across, you want to talk about anything else, please hop in. And last but not least, the Agile Uprising is committed to always being free. However, we do have a Patreon. If you are enjoying the content and you do feel so inclined, you might actually get a surprise goodie bag in the mail from yours truly. We did just get some new stickers and some pins. So who knows? Once again, Jardina, I want to thank you for joining us. And on behalf of Gina and myself, I want to thank all of you listeners again. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.